39. It was a little travelled arm of the hyperweb, one that had seen only sporadic traffic since the slashers had begun to map the network's further fringes. Five portals lay close together in a loose, drifting quincunx, separated by no more than a light second of interstellar space. There were no suns here, no worlds, no rogue moons, not even the rocky fragments of them, unborn or shattered. Only the spired husks of five large comets, dry and dead for billions of years, each of which formed an anchor for a single unmanned portal. But there was something else. Sensors groped for it in the darkness. It was unthinkably dark, illuminated only by starlight. It was also unthinkably huge, as wide across as the sun itself, with room to spare. "Are we too late?" Orga said as Tunguska assembled a composite picture of the ALS on one of the walls. "I don't know. If my timing's correct, Niagara should only have achieved portal egress 90 minutes ago." "Then why don't we see him?" "There's a faint thrust trail," Tunguska said. "It suggests that Niagara already passed around the limb of the ALS. Again, assuming that the usual margins were ignored, he would have had just enough time to do that. So follow him." "We are. Unfortunately, the bleed drive needs further attention. This is the maximum acceleration we can sustain." The composite image of the ALS gained detail by the second, as Tunguska's sensors teased more structure out of the darkness. Complex statistical methods squeezed the maximum information from meager data. Orga recalled the briefing she had been given aboard the 20th Century Limited. Peter's schematic representation had been tinted a dull blue-gray, but there was not enough light here to trigger the eye's color receptors. Tunguska's schematic ignored the faint ambient illumination and painted the entire structure a flat gray, with no shadowing except that necessary to suggest the plate-like surface texturing. In Peter's overview, the plate-like structure had made her think of something viral or crystalline, but now the hide of the ALS reminded her of some magnified view of human or animal skin, with a rough hint of irregularity and, here and there, signs where healing processes had not quite erased the evidence of former injuries. It was as if the ALS had been grown rather than constructed. Perhaps it had. No one had the slightest idea where the raw materials had come from. Maybe there had once been an entire solar system in this pocket of space, which had then been efficiently strip-mined to create the hard, thin shell of the sphere. Or perhaps the necessary mass energy had been conjured out of nothing, in some vastly more sophisticated version of the principle that underpinned the bleed drive. Orga looked at Floyd, wondering how he was taking all of this. "Not many people get to see this," she said, "if that's any consolation." "I could have lived without it," he said. "Somehow I rather liked the idea that I could trust the night sky, or that the sun was real." "Your world is real, Floyd, and so are you. Nothing else matters." "I'm picking something up," Tunguska said with quiet urgency. "It could be Niagara." "An echo from his ship?" Orga asked. "Not close enough for that," he said, "but there's a moving patch of enhanced brightness on the skin of the ALS. It's probably the reflection from his drive. He's doing his best to hide it, but there's only so much he can do if he still wants to steer." "Remind me, do we have any more missiles in this thing?" Orga asked. "None. I've instructed the factories to make more, but I can't afford to divert too much repair capacity away from the bleed drive. I think we'll have to rely on beams, at least until later." "Are we in firing range?" "Not yet. We'll have to close quite a bit of distance for that." "Can we get close enough?" Orga asked. "Not if Niagara maintains his latest heading, but that reflection signature suggests that he's slowing down relative to the ALS. "Why would he do that?" asked Floyd. "Probably because he's ready to deploy the Molotov device," Tunguska said. "You have to hit him before he has a chance." "Are you sure you want that, Floyd? If that antimatter bomb doesn't blow a hole in the ALS, you won't be going home."
"Just do it," Floyd said. "Worry about my return ticket later. A few hours ago, I wasn't even expecting to live this long."
"I don't think any of us were," Tunguska replied. His forehead creased, revealing some glint of interest in the storm of numbers flooding his head. "Ah, now this may be significant." He looked around at their expectant faces. "I have some refined data on that reflection pattern. It looks as if there are two sources of light rather than one." Orga wondered if she understood him.
"Two thrust beams?"
"Yes,
but far enough apart that they can't be associated with the same craft. It looks as if Niagara's deployed a smaller ship from the larger one. We should have a hard echo any moment now. He pressed a thick finger against one side of his temple. That makes sense, Augur said. His main ship is just large enough to carry the Molotov device, right? So it would seem. He's probably going to plow it into the ALS like a battering ram. Too much trouble to extract the antimatter core when he already has a ready-made delivery system. She pushed forward in her seat, ignoring the tension in her back. The other ship must be a shuttle, something with enough range to make it to E2. That would be the ship carrying Silver Rain, Tunguska said. And Niagara, Augur added. Tunguska shut his eyes, blanking out the extraneous distraction of the real world. I see the shuttle. And the mothership, he said. The shuttle is on a high G-burn trajectory away from the Molotov section. Looks like it's trying to put as much distance between itself and the blast point as possible, Augur speculated. Tunguska nodded, his eyes still closed. Well, you would, wouldn't you? Floyd commented. Any chance of a beam strike anytime soon? She asked. Not yet. Believe me, my trigger finger is itching. There was nothing to do but wait for the distance to be closed. Tunguska's long-range view gradually sharpened, confirming that the two ships had indeed separated, and that the heavier of the two, the main craft, the one that they had been following from Earth, was racing on an accelerating trajectory towards the surface of the ALS, gunning its bleed drive to the wall. The excess radiation from the tortured drive made it an easy object to track, even across such a distance. An hour earlier, it had been moving parallel to the surface of the sphere, but now it was daggering down on a course that would intersect the surface at a right angle. We can't stop this, can we? Augur said, exasperated. That damn thing is going to hit the ALS no matter what we do. But admit it, Tunguska said, with more playfulness than she cared for. Aren't you just a little bit curious to see what will happen? I could stand not knowing, she said. Tunguska opened his eyes. Report from the bleed drive. We're ready to increase our thrust to 5 Gs. Can't risk anything higher than that for now at least. We won't need the acceleration caskets, although the ship will still have to immobilize us. Whatever it takes, Augur said. The room quivered and swallowed them. In the soft grip of the ship's protective systems, time surged and dragged in unpredictable dreamlike waves. She wondered how it was for Floyd, whose head was free of twinkling machines. What was he thinking now that he was so close to home, and simultaneously so close to seeing everything he knew destroyed? By my estimation, Tunguska said, the Molotov impact will happen in 50 seconds. I'm deploying expendable sensors, but closing off all our usual channels. No one's ever seen a big matter-antimatter explosion up close, and there's no telling what kind of reaction the blast will provoke from the ALS itself. How close is that shuttle to the impact point? Augur asked. About half our present distance, Tunguska replied. His shielding had better be good if he wants to be alive at the end of this. 30 seconds. I can do without the countdown, Tunguska, Augur said, bracing herself. Just tell us if we're still alive at the end of it. She felt, when it happened, some ghostly report of the blast, even though Tunguska assured her that no signals could possibly reach her through the barricades he had put in place. It was long and drawn out, like a distant peal of thunder. The Molotov device has detonated, Tunguska said, and we, self-evidently, are still alive. I was being sarcastic. I wasn't. It's always good to confirm these things. When the expendable sensors deemed it safe, Tunguska unshuttered the ship's more delicate eyes and turned them on the scene of the crime. It took a little while for them to make sense of the data, for the view was obstructed by a slowly expanding debris plume, spreading away from the impact point like a cherry-red fountain. Augur grappled with the scale, but she still couldn't adjust to the mind-numbing size of the ALS object. The plume was huge, hundreds of thousands of kilometers across and still growing, but it was just a tiny detail on the surface of the sphere. Debris is clearing near the epicenter, Tunguska said. The view is foreshortened, so it isn't easy to see exactly what damage has been done. Just show us what you've got, Augur said. They had to wait 20 minutes until the plume had dissipated sufficiently, and their angle of observation improved enough to allow a clearer view. By then, Tunguska's ship was following the same arcing trajectory as Niagara's, curving around for a hard interception with the ALS. They were still sustaining 5Gs, cocooned against harm. "They've broken through," Tunguska said. He pushed an image into Auger's head. The Molotov device had punched a surprisingly neat little entry wound into the skin of the ALS. The hole was 100 kilometers across and nearly circular. The kilometer-thick skin glowed painfully bright around the edge of the hole, shading down through blue and yellow and charred red, out to a distance of perhaps 200 or 300 kilometers from the epicenter. There were hints of wild, lashing structures in the exposed cross-section, flailing like severed nerve endings. "Dear Christ," Auger said. "They did it. The damn thing didn't put up any kind of fight at all." "Did you expect it to?" Floyd asked.
"I expected something."
"What about the other ship?" "Still tracking it," Tunguska said. "She's under thrust and maintaining the course she was following before the blast. It will take her through the wound in under 10 minutes. Maybe he shouldn't have been so concerned about the state of Niagara's shielding, she thought. "I take it we're still not within beam range." "No." Tunguska sounded genuinely embarrassed. "We'll have to follow her in for that." "Through the wound?" "Yes," Tunguska said. "Into the ALS. I'm afraid it's the only course available to us." 40. By the time they were about to pass through the hole that Niagara had punched into the ALS, the debris cloud had completely cleared. The wound remained raw and bright, spilling a faint shaft of re-radiated golden-white light back into space, twinkling off the few remaining shards of hot matter still hanging around the impact site. "That light has the spectrum of solar radiation," Tunguska said, when they were falling down the column of light. "It's a perfect match for the sun, at the limit of our instruments." The transition between outside and inside happened in an eye blink. 1 kilometer of shell thickness was nothing compared to their speed. One moment, the surface of the sphere was swelling larger, with the wound growing rapidly from a searing, white-rimmed eye to a swallowing mouth, and then they were through, falling towards the heart of the ALS. Tunguska's sensors took immediate stock of the interior. Behind his ship, the receding wound embraced a circle of the perfect blackness of interstellar space. It was rimmed with bright, agonized matter on this side as well. But instead of the quilted blue-gray material of the outer skin, the inner surface of the ALS was made of something far stranger, something far less susceptible to easy interrogation by Tunguska's instruments. They had always known that the inner surface of the shell had to function as a kind of near-perfect planetarium, projecting an image of the sky that would have been seen from the original Earth. There were false stars, their brightness and colors reproduced precisely, aligned into exactly the right constellations that the inhabitants of E2 had learned to expect. Some fraction of the stars must even have been programmed for variability, to dim and brighten according to intricate astrophysics-rich algorithms. They were all required to move with respect to each other, following the slow, stately currents of proper motion or the wheeling gyre of binary orbits. Beyond the stars, there were galaxies, vast shoals of them in every direction. Each and every galaxy had to stand up to the same scrutiny as the stars. Novae and supernovae had to flare and die, whether they were noticed or not. It was awesome and astonishing. It was also doomed to failure, for no such tapestry could ever have withstood arbitrarily close study using the kind of astronomical tools available in Auger's era. Even a simple interplanetary probe would have eventually sniffed out something odd about those stellar positions, just before it dashed itself to atoms by colliding with the inner surface of the shell. No, it wasn't perfectly foolproof, nor must that ever have been the intention of its builders. It was good enough to withstand examination using the crude science of Floyd's time, but it was never the intention that the shell should form an utterly convincing illusion. Sooner or later, it must have been assumed, the inhabitants of E2 were bound to discover the truth. The function of the ALS was to protect them from outside interference until precisely that moment. After that, at which point they would probably direct their energies into breaking through the shell, they were on their own. But there was already something amiss with the view of the heavens around the inside edge of the open wound. For thousands of kilometers in all directions, the stars were distorted, elongated and sperm-like, their stretched, tapering tails pointing like accusing fingers towards the hole Niagara had made. "The zone of distortion is spreading," Tunguska said. Frankly, they're going to have a hard time not noticing that on Earth, even if they somehow missed the initial flash. What will they make of it? Auger wondered. I don't know, but if an inexplicable astronomical puzzle is all they have to worry about by the end of the day, they'll be doing rather well. Can we shoot that shuttle down yet? She asked. No, he replied, but I'm ready to squeeze a little more out of the bleed drive. If my estimates are good, we still have a chance of intercepting her before she hits the atmosphere. Don't hesitate, Tunguska. I won't. There is something I feel I should mention, though. It's just an observation, and it may be misleading. Auger didn't like the sound of that at all. Tell us anyway. The wound appears to be healing itself. The aperture was more than 100 kilometers across immediately after the detonation of the Molotov device. And now? A shade under 100. It may not mean anything. It's rather difficult to define the precise boundary, but I thought I should draw it to your attention. Keep an eye on it, she said. I don't want that damn thing closing on us while we're still inside. I'll have a better idea of the closure rate in a little while, Tunguska said. Squeeze as much speed out of this thing as you can. Then we can all go home. For the next hour, they pushed deeper into the ALS, following the lone echo of Niagara's shuttle. All attempts at communication were ignored, although that did not stop Tunguska from making repeated offers of negotiation. He was, he said, prepared to consider any proposal that would stop the deployment of Silver Rain, but no acknowledgement of his messages ever returned. Despite the urgent need to intercept the shuttle before it reached Earth's atmosphere, Auger could not help marveling at the experience of being inside the ALS sphere and seeing her world as it should have been. This was an Earth that had never known nuclear war, or runaway climatic catastrophe, or smart weather, or a nanocaust. The sight of it made her want to weep. No image had ever come close to the heartbreaking beauty of this small blue world, a beauty all the more acute now that she knew how exquisitely fragile it was. It was the beauty of a butterfly's wing. E2 hung at the exact geometric center of the ALS. Orbiting it, or at least moving in a convincing simulacrum of Newtonian motion, was what appeared to be an identical copy of the moon. Auger presumed it had been captured in the same quantum snapshot as E2, but it would take close-up investigation to verify this. The moon could just as easily be a mocked-up representation, imbued with enough detail to fool surface observers and enough gravity to lift tides on the Earth. The remaining contribution to the tides, the solar component, must have been achieved through some deft trickery of gravitational manipulation, invisible small orbiting masses, perhaps, for there was no sun. Instead, there was a golden-yellow disk of exactly the right temperature and apparent brightness shining out from the inner surface of the sphere. But it was only designed to look convincing from the vantage point of Earth's surface, and, close to, they saw how its shape was distorted by the sphere's concavity. "There's your source of solar spectrum radiation," Auger said. "From outside the sphere, we were seeing its light, leaking through the hole. How long do you think it would have taken Floyd's people to figure that out?" Even without spaceflight, they'd have begun to notice some puzzling things about it within a few decades, Tunguska said. In our timeline, a great deal of attention was focused on measuring the circularity of the solar disk, since it turned out to be a way of discriminating between competing cosmological models. With that kind of attention, the illusion probably couldn't have been sustained for long. Or maybe they'd just pick another theory, Auger said. Perhaps. Anyway, Floyd's world hasn't achieved the science ours did even by 1959. They could quickly make up lost ground, Tunguska said, and then they might put up too much of a fight if someone attempted to do what Niagara is attempting now. Which means that whoever was working behind the scenes had serious coordination, Auger said, enough to change the outcome of the Second World War before it became truly global. And whoever did that is still down there. You think they deserve retribution, don't you? Tunguska asked. Of course. Don't you? They stopped a war in which millions died in our timeline, Auger. No final solution, no Russian front, no Hiroshima, Nagasaki. They didn't stop that war out of the goodness of their hearts, Tunguska. They stopped it because it interfered with their plans for global genocide, and now I think they should pay for it. Well, we're almost within attack range, if that's any consolation. That little shuttle is having to decelerate in preparation for atmospheric flight, If it released Silverain at this speed, even the ablative jackets wouldn't protect the nanomachinery at the heart of the weapon. There's some uncertainty, but I can begin attempting the strike within 3 minutes. What about the missiles you promised us? She asked. Nearly ready. Patience, please. She heard a note of diffidence in his voice. Concerning the other matter.
What other matter?
The healing of the wound. I've been keeping a close eye on it, and I can now state with some authority that... Is there still time for us to get out?
Yes, allowing for...
I don't need anything else to worry about, Tunguska.
Good, in which case I won't mention the bleed drive.
Tunguska was as good as his word. Barely 2 minutes later, Auger felt the slight change in the ship's attack posture that indicated it was bringing its beam weapons to bear. When they powered up and fired, discharging in timed salvos, she felt the surging and ebbing of massive accumulators somewhere in the ship's gut.
How long can we sustain this fire rate? She asked.
For as long as it takes. Energy isn't a problem.
The shuttle had anticipated a beam weapon strike. Tunguska said this was almost inevitable, but it was limited in its defensive options. It could drop reflective chaff by shedding discrete layers of its hull, but not indefinitely. It could change its course randomly, making it more difficult for the beams to lock on to the bright aura of its drive flame, which was pointed away from them now, but still visible against the background of E2 and the inner surface of the ALS sphere. But every course correction cost it some of its hard-won lead. For the pilot of the shuttle, it was the trickiest of trade-offs to balance.
Whatever Niagara does, Tunguska said, it will hurt him in the long run. All my simulations now point to a successful interception before he's within drop range of the atmosphere. There was something about the cocksure confidence of that statement that gave Auger goose pimples. It was like an invitation to fate. That was when the bleed drive chose to fail again. She felt the ship stall in its chase, suddenly losing ground on its victim. The drive stuttered, pushing hard and then cutting out. The cushioning embrace of the ship did its best to smooth over the sudden changes in acceleration, but Auger still felt several lapses in consciousness as the blood in her brain sloshed around like mud in a bucket.
Tunguska, she gasped when she was able. Maybe you want to rethink.
The ship was in freefall. The drive had died completely, shut down by emergency control systems before instabilities opened a drooling mouth in the flesh of space itself. Over the next several minutes, repair estimates began to trickle in. The drive was still fixable, but the patches put in place since the missile attack had now outlived their usefulness. It would take many hours before even a moderate push of 1G could be achieved. Sensing that its charges no longer needed to be buffered against the jolts and swerves of combat, the ship relinquished its hold on Floyd, Auger, and Tunguska, the white cocoons collapsing back into the familiar forms of table, chairs, floor, walls, and ceiling.
I hope, Auger said, that you have a backup plan, Tunguska, because otherwise we're screwed.
Tunguska, to his credit, still managed to retain a credible gloss of authority. I've already reviewed the options, he said. You'll be pleased to hear that there is still a way of intercepting that spacecraft.
The missiles? Floyd asked.
No. He gave a self-critical grimace. Well, yes, but it's not quite that simple.
Auger looked at Floyd and rolled her eyes. It never is. What's your plan?
The missiles don't have the range from here. My internal repair factories have license to manufacture almost anything, except complete bleed drive assemblies. I had to settle for small, crude fusion power plants. They're fast and agile enough for the task, and they'll double as warheads, but only if they're given a helping hand.
The tone of his voice said beware. Whatever he was offering them, it was not without its costs.
Such as? Auger asked.
They'll need a delivery system. We can't get close enough at the moment, and by the time the ship's fixed, it'll be too late. But we still have the shuttle from the 20th. I had it fueled and repaired as a matter of insurance. It's a trivial matter to attach two missiles to it. They can grip the hull themselves like parasites.
Can the shuttle make it in time? Floyd asked.
Just. Although the margin for error is on the tight side. Someone will have to fly it.
Don't you have a snake robot that can do it? Auger asked.
Not one that I can spare from the repair work.
Auger made to stand. Then what are we waiting for?
Tunguska motioned for her to stay where she was.
When I said someone has to fly it, I meant myself. There's no reason why I can't fly it instead, Augur said. Whatever knowledge you have, Cassandra can give to me.
That's not a good idea, Tunguska said.
Why not? The machines will show me what I have to do.
That's not the point. I have no doubt that they could give you the necessary competence, but it's much better if I take the shuttle, with Floyd as a passenger.
I don't follow, Augur said. He sighed, as if he'd been hoping that he would not have to explain.
The problem is that whoever rides that shuttle may never make it home.
He made a steeple of his fingers, slowing his voice so that every word had the measured emphasis of some terrible pronouncement.
Intercepting Niagara is still feasible, even now. But by the time the shuttle releases its missiles, it will barely have time to return to this point, let alone leave the ALS completely. The wound is closing. It will be a very, very close-run thing, even if the wound does not quicken its rate of closure, which I cannot guarantee. He took a deep breath and looked at Augur, which is why you cannot be on that shuttle. You will remain here, ready to depart the ALS as soon as the bleed drive can be restarted. And you? I will ensure that the missiles find their mark. When that is done, I will return Floyd to the surface of E2. And then, she said, I will evaluate the situation. If circumstances permit, I will attempt to return to this ship. If they don't, well, I can't leave the shuttle lying around in the ALS, where Floyd's people might find it. I'll arrange for its disposal. It shouldn't be difficult. Augur wanted to make sure that she understood exactly what he meant. Kill yourself, in other words? If you must put it so bluntly. She shook her head. That's not how it's going to happen. You already said I could fly the ship as well as you.
What I said, Tunguska began. I'm taking Floyd home, she said. I dragged him into this, so I can damned well drag him out of it.
Floyd reached out and took her arm.
No. Listen to Tunguska. He's talking a lot of sense.
You'd condemn him to save me. No one's talking about condemning anymore. He doesn't have to commit suicide. He can always keep looking for another way out.
Then I can do the same, Augur said. She snapped around to the slasher. Get us on that ship.
Us. Floyd and me.
And Cassie, he asked slowly.
We've discussed the matter, Augur said. Cassandra wants to come along for the ride.
Tunguska's face formed an expression of defeat, and he shook his head.
You shouldn't make me do this.
But I am. I still need another 20 minutes to finish the missiles and interface them with the shuttle's avionics. I've figured that time into my calculations, so use it wisely. There's still a chance to change your mind.
I don't need more time. My mind's made up, Augur said.
Tunguska gave a weary smile, accepting that there was nothing to be gained from further debate.
I always knew you'd want it this way, he said. I just had to be certain.
May I ask one small favor before we say goodbye? Floyd asked.
If I can help, I will.
I need something from you. 2 things, really. Tunguska spread his hands wide in a gesture of reasonableness.
What can I do?
You can make almost anything on this ship, can't you?
Within limits.
I'm not asking for the world. I just need you to conjure up some strawberries for me.
One corner of Tunguska's mouth pulled up in a half smile, as if he'd either misheard or was the victim of a joke he didn't get.
Strawberries. Can you do that?
Yes. Tunguska mulled the point, or at least something that looks and tastes like strawberries, even if it wouldn't be exactly the real article.
I'm not fussy. Can you do that in 20 minutes?
I can do that in 5, if you want to eat them immediately.
They're not for me, Floyd said. I don't even like strawberries.
They're for a friend. So I'll need them in a bag.
In a bag.
That's right.
Tunguska nodded, his expression grave.
And the other thing.
I need some of that magic medicine of yours.
You are.
Someone I know is dying. It's the same lady who wants the strawberries.
41. Tunguska led them through winding white corridors where weightless conditions applied, until they reached a clean, vacuum-filled kernel somewhere near the stern of his ship.
It was here that he had entombed the shuttle from the 20th Century Limited, since he had rescued them from falling back onto the frozen Earth. The shuttle looked newer than when Auger had last seen it from the outside, its surfaces buffed and bright, dents and bumps repaired, scratches healed, scorch marks gone. Had it not been for the flying horse logo of its owning company, she doubted that she would have recognized it as the same vessel. "I'm amazed that you didn't throw it out as a piece of junk," Auger said. "I'd have been more likely to recycle it for raw matter," Tunguska said. "But, like I said, it's insurance." "Never hurts," Floyd said. Two missiles were in place now, sleek, smooth, shark-like forms hugging the hull and attached to it with extruded pads. "They'll do the job. You're sure of that?" Auger asked. "I'm a little wary of dogmatic assertions after the last little debacle, but yes, I have a measure of confidence in them." "And the shuttle?" "She'll hold." "Then let's go." Tunguska escorted them aboard. The ship was already humming, powered up for immediate flight. It smelled clean, like something that had just been unwrapped. "Fuel tanks are full," he said, indicating the control console. "Had to siphon some hydrogen from our cooling system, but I don't think we'll miss it." "Thanks, Tunguska," Auger said. "If there was anything else I could do for you." "You've done more than enough. You and Cassandra both. All of you. I'm very grateful." "That goes double for me," Floyd said. "We all share a collective responsibility for Niagara's crime," Tunguska said. "Then let's hope he doesn't get a chance to commit it. Can you forgive us, Auger?" She thought about it for a moment. "I think we all need a little forgiveness, don't we? Some more than others." She took Tunguska's big hand in her own. "I know what I'm doing here. So does Floyd. Don't wait around for us. The minute you get that bleed drive back up and running, haul yourselves out of here. I'll be waiting for you on the other side," Tunguska said. He squeezed her hand. "In the meantime, good luck. Give my regards to Niagara. I wish I could deliver my sentiments in person." "I'll make it count for both of us," Auger said. Departure was routine. When they were an hour into the flight, Auger turned to Floyd and said, "There's something we need to talk about. Can it wait until we've dealt with Niagara?" "There might not be enough time then." The script, the words she had prepared in her mind, dried up somewhere in her throat. All she could manage was, "What are you going to do now?" He looked at her as if it was the silliest question anyone had ever asked. "Now? With the rest of your life, I mean. Now that you know everything. Now that you won't be able to take a breath without remembering that nothing around you is really what it seems. I guess I'll do what everyone else does. Get on with my life and forget the big questions." "That's not much of an answer." "It's the truth. I still need shoes on my feet. I still need to feed myself and take care of the electricity bill. I still need to put a roof over my head no matter what's above the sky. Anyway, that isn't to say I haven't got a few plans. Plans you want to tell me about?" "My first duty is to Christine," Floyd said. "I still have to get the police off his case. That means dealing with Mylol and maybe finding some leverage over Inspector Belliard. There's at least one dead war baby in the tunnel at Cardinal Lemoine. Mylol may need a live one before he can do anything for me. But I won't know until I telephone him." "That won't take forever." "That isn't everything I've got planned. After that, I'm going after the other fish, whoever they are. Other fish like Kaliskan's brother. If he's there, I'll find him. And if I find him, I'll make him talk." "These are dangerous people," Auger said. "I know. They're organized and willing to kill to protect their secrets. They have no qualms about attempting to murder 3 billion people. They're not going to lose any sleep over one little detective." "Then maybe they won't see me coming. And I won't be alone. I'll have Christine on my side. Maybe Mylol, if I can talk some sense into him. Between us, we might make a difference." "You've already made a difference," she said. "If you hadn't taken Blanchard seriously, everything that Susan did would have been lost. We'd never have known about Niagara's plan." "It was a case," Floyd said with an easy shrug. "It needed closing." Floyd felt the shuttle shudder as the first missile unglued itself and sped away, riding a spike of flame like a splinter chipped from the sun. It was 6 hours since they had departed Tunguska's ship, but it had felt more like 20. There had been nothing to do but wait as the shuttle positioned itself for the strike. Nothing to do but worry that Niagara was going to pull some last-minute trick that would throw all of Tunguska's careful stratagems into disarray. But the chase had unfolded with meticulous obeisance to the attack simulations, right down to the last moment before missile release. Niagara had nothing else to offer. No alternative but continue his race towards E2's atmosphere and hope that he arrived there first. He must have known that it had become a suicide mission for him. That even if he succeeded in dropping the Silver Rain spore onto E2, he would never survive to see their murderous effect. The two ships were now close enough to accommodate the limited range of the makeshift missiles. Niagara's shuttle was on a forced parabolic that had already carried it to within 1,000 kilometers of E2's surface, while the 20th shuttle lagged behind by less than half that distance. They watched the thrust trail of the missile stab down towards the cloud-flecked hemisphere of the Pacific Ocean. None of the instruments aboard the shuttle were capable of displaying the disposition of the missile, but Cassandra's machines ferried a constant commentary directly into Auger's head, a ceaseless babble of telemetry that occasionally made her wince in protest as the numbers overwhelmed her ability to process them. Floyd looked at her, waiting for an update. "Closing," she said, "still looking good." Below, against the backdrop of the ocean, Floyd could just make out the glint of the ship they were chasing. It was still 500 kilometers away, but, apart from the missile, it was the only thing moving against the face of E2, spitting a brilliant, quivering flame as it continued to make evasive course changes, still trying to dodge anything they might throw at it. 400 kilometers, Auger said. "Missile still looking good. Tunguska might have built it in a hurry, but he did a pretty good job. I'm glad he's on our side." "Me too. Floyd, this might not be the ideal time." "When is it ever?" "Whatever happens from here on, I'm not sorry we met. I'm not sorry we had this adventure." "Really?" "Never in a million years." Then she frowned as the machines delivered another bulletin straight into her skull. 200 clicks and closing. Niagara knows there's a missile on his tail now. Floyd saw the little spark of Niagara's drive flame become even more agitated, lashing from side to side like a feather in the wind. He wondered what that kind of swerving meant for anyone still alive in that ship. Perhaps Niagara and his associates were all dead by now, mashed by the forces of the escape, sacrificing themselves so that their cargo might still find its way to E2. Or maybe he was still alive and in pain. Floyd knew which option he preferred. "Something's changing," Auger said. "The albedo of Niagara's ship." Floyd saw it too, that moving glint becoming a moving smudge of silver light, just for an instant. It looked as if Niagara's ship had blown up. He dared to believe that might be the case, that the missile had somehow leapt across space faster than it was meant to. But the spike of the drive exhaust continued to burn, sharp and clean as a stiletto. "What just happened? Did we?" "No, we didn't. He just sloughed a large part of his hull, discarding it like an old skin. That can only mean one thing, Floyd. He's ready to drop the spore." The ship shuddered. The second and last missile was away. "First missile closing. 60 clicks. 40. 20. Floyd stared down, willing an outcome with all the strength he had, but the silver smudge kept moving. 0, Auger said. 0. Fuck! The first missile cleaved into the atmosphere, pushing down into the skies above some spray of mid-Pacific islands Floyd didn't recognize. "Can't turn it around in time," Auger said. "Try it." But the missile had already selected its own fate. A pinprick of light blossomed, rapidly becoming bright enough to hurt, and just as quickly faded. "Warhead self-detonated. This isn't good. Second fish. Homing. Closing on 300 clicks. The moving smudge of Niagara's ship suddenly reversed its direction of thrust. Even without magnification, Floyd saw the craft visibly alter its crawl across the backdrop of the ocean. The great sea was as bright and clear and smooth as a marble, clouds and islands dappled across its unblemished face with painterly precision, in broken lines and elegant curves. It was his world, as no one had ever seen it before, and it was enough to make him gasp. He was sorry. It was a wonderful, glorious sight, but there just wasn't time to enjoy the view. Maybe next time.
Bastard's slowing, Auger said.
He's ready. 250 clicks. Missile slowing.
Slowing?
The missile's learning from its mate, trying not to make the same mistake.
I really hope it knows what it's doing.
200 clicks. Still slowing. Maybe it's malfunctioned. Oh shit, I hope it hasn't malfunctioned.
If it has, we need to think about ramming with this thing.
Auger looked back at him. He couldn't tell whether her expression was impressed or horrified.
Don't worry about that, she said. I've already got the intercept programmed in.
Nice of you to tell me.
I'd have got round to it.
She blinked, started to say something. Floyd could almost feel the torrent of numbers sluicing through her head.
The fish, Auger?
Slowing to 100 kilometers.
No.
Wait.
She hesitated.
Wait. It's sprinting again.
Keep talking.
It's too late. It's not going to.
The second warhead detonated, the same pinprick of light, swelling in size and brightness. But this time it kept on swelling. Floyd jammed his eyes shut, and still that did no good. The light pushing through his skin, through his bones, cleansing every thought in his head, save the acknowledgement of its own intolerable luminosity, like a proclamation from God. And then a slow, stately fade, and then nothing. Just empty skies.
There were no dampeners on that detonation, Auger said, her voice distant and disconnected, like someone speaking in a dream. It made no effort to limit its blast. It must have been confident it could make the kill.
There's nothing out there.
I know.
That means we did it, Floyd said.
It means we saved the Earth.
One of them, she corrected.
One's enough for today.
Let's not get greedy.
42. It was daylight over the Pacific, and therefore night over Paris. Clouds wrapped the city, fog choking its streets with cold, constricting coils. The shuttle dropped through the weather like a stone through smoke, conserving fuel, retarding its descent with the minimum expenditure of thrust. Closer to the ground, it reconfigured its flight surfaces and became passably aerodynamic. Hypersonic, then supersonic, then subsonic, until the shuttle lowered itself through the main swell of clouds into a gloomy window of clear air. Districts of the city picked out in the lights of buildings, street lamps, and moving cars poked through the low quilt of fog. Here the swell of Montmartre and the Sacré-Cœur, there the dark ribbon of the Seine, there the glowing carnival of the Champs-Élysées, like a river of light.
Look, Auger said with a childlike glee, there's the Eiffel Tower. It's still here, still intact. It's still standing.
Everything's still here, Floyd said.
Isn't it wonderful?
It grows on you.
We never deserved this second chance, she said.
But sometimes you get what you don't deserve.
The console chimed. Auger strained forward and answered the call.
Tunguska here, they heard. I must offer my congratulations. We saw the kill strike even at a distance of 3 light seconds.
Auger let him finish speaking before asking, The spore? Could Silverain have survived the blast?
His reply crawled back 6 seconds later. Unlikely.
I hope you're right.
I hope I am too.
He sounded more amused than alarmed, as if he had exhausted any final reserves of worry.
I suppose at this point, all one can realistically do is hope for the best. Are you both intact?
Auger flashed Floyd a glance.
As intact as we'll ever be.
Good. You did well. I'm afraid, though, that there isn't much time to dwell on your success. The wound is closing fast. Our bleed drive is a little unsteady, but we can begin to limp our way to the exit.
Go then, Auger said.
The thing is, Tunguska said, I was rather hoping you'd come with us. There's also the small matter of you now being Cassandra's custodian, and I would like nothing better than for her to return to Polity Space.
Floyd leaned over, straining against his harness.
She's keeping that appointment, Tunguska.
Floyd, Auger said.
Start your limp home, Floyd told Tunguska, but be prepared to pick up this shuttle at the last minute. As soon as Auger's dropped me off, she'll be on her way back to you immediately.
Telemetry suggests you have sufficient fuel, Tunguska said guardedly. If you begin your return journey practically as soon as you land, if you delay, there are no guarantees. I hope I make myself clear.
In technicolor, Floyd said.
It was a strip of vacant ground between two abandoned churches, somewhere south of the Longchamp Hippodrome. If anyone had seen the shuttle lower down through the fog, screaming out of the night on vertical thrust, they had elected not to stay around for the end of the performance. Perhaps a few vagrants, drunkards, or gypsies had seen it arrive. Before scratching their heads and deciding that this was really not the kind of thing they needed to be involved in, especially given the city authorities' usual attitude to people poking their noses where they weren't welcome. Whatever it was, they would have concluded, it was very unlikely to be there in the morning. Now the ship sat on its lowered undercarriage, gleaming in reflected lamplight like a chromed egg, the fog swirling around its hot exhaust ports in curious little eddies, while the ship ticked and cooled like an old oven. The Flying Horse logo of Pegasus Intersolar seemed to strain towards the sky, anxious not to spend a minute longer on the ground than necessary. Floyd and Auger stood under the ship, at the base of its lowered access ramp. "Did you remember the strawberries?" Auger asked. Floyd held up the little bag, as if I'd forget. "You never did tell me who they were for, or the UR you persuaded Tunguska to give you." Floyd fingered the little glass vial in his pocket. It contained a harmless-looking silvery-gray fluid, tasteless and odorless, but slipped into the right person's diet, it would infect their body with a billion tireless machines, which would identify and cure almost any illness known to slasher science. It was bottled immortality. Well, not quite. Tunguska had quailed at the thought of giving him the kind of full strength you are that would keep someone alive forever. At the time he had handed over the gift, they were, after all, still trying to prevent someone else from introducing a plague of tiny machines into E2. The UR would heal someone of any illnesses they had at the moment of ingestion, and the tiny machines would endure long enough to steer them to full health and through a period of grace thereafter. But then they would quietly disassemble, flushing themselves from the person's body as so much microscopic metallic dust. That person might go on to live for many more years, but by the same token, they might fall ill of some other complaint a month later. If they did, the machines would not be around to save them a second time. So it wasn't immortality, but from where he was standing, it was a lot better than nothing. He took his hand out of his pocket, leaving the vial where it was. "You have to go now, Auger." "What if I said I was staying?" He smiled. She was putting on a brave face, but deep down, he knew she had made up her mind. He just needed to make her feel better about it. "You have a life back home. This can be my home." "You know it can't. Not now. Not ever. It's a nice dream, Auger. It was a nice vacation. But that's all it was." She pulled him closer and kissed him. Floyd kissed her back, not letting her pull away, embracing her there in the fog as if by force of will he could hold back time, as if time itself might make a compassionate exception in their case. Then gently he pulled away from her. She was crying. He wiped her tears away with his sleeve. "Don't cry. I love you, Floyd." "I love you too, Auger. But that doesn't change anything. I can't just leave you like this. You have no choice." She looked back at the waiting ship. He knew what she was thinking, how every second now counted against her escaping from the ALS. "You're a good man, Floyd. I will see you again. I promise you that. We'll find another way in, another way back to Paris."
"Maybe there is no other way."
"But I won't stop looking for one. Not just for you, but for the other agents stuck here, the people you and I have never even met. They're still out there, Floyd. Still somewhere in the world, in America or Africa, unaware that there is no way home. Maybe some of them got enough of a warning to start their journeys back to Paris. But they won't have got there yet. Some of them won't arrive for weeks or months. When they do, they'll make their way to Cardinal Lemoine or Susan's apartment. Anywhere they think they might find an answer. They'll be confused and scared, Floyd. They'll need a friend. Someone who can tell them what happened. They'll need someone who cares. Someone who can give them hope. Someone who'll tell them we're coming back, no matter how difficult it is, no matter how long it takes." She pulled him closer, but it was just a hug this time. It was past the time for kisses.
"You should go," he said at last.
"I know."
She let go of him and took one step onto the ramp.
I meant what I said, about not regretting a minute of this. Not even the dirt and the bruises and the part where you got shot. Not a damned minute.
Floyd lifted a finger to his brow in salute.
Good. That's exactly how I feel. Now please, would you get the hell off my planet?
She nodded, saying nothing more, and walked back up the ramp, keeping her face turned to him.
Floyd took a step back, his eyes welling with tears now, not wanting her to see them. Not because of some stupid male pride in not crying, but because he didn't want to make this any harder on the two of them than it already was.
Floyd?
Yes?
I want you to remember me. Whenever you walk the streets, know that I'll also be walking them. It may not be the same Paris, but
it's still Paris.
And we'll always have it, Auger said. She stepped into the ship. He saw her face disappear, then her body, then her legs. Then the ramp lifted up.
Floyd stepped back. The ship growled, spat fire, and then slowly clawed its way back into the sky.
He stood there for many minutes, like a man who had lost his way in the fog. It was only when he heard a distant rumble of thunder that he turned around and began to make his way back to the city he knew, the city he felt some tenuous claim on. Somewhere far above him, Auger was on her way home.
Tunguska had cleared a large area of wall and assigned it to display a visual feed, suitably doctored to bring out detail and color of the closing wound in the ALS. They were through it now and back into empty space, but the last hour of the escape had still been as anxious as any Auger could remember. The wound's rate of closure had surged and decelerated with savage unpredictability, mocking any attempts to predict its future progress.
Things might actually have been worse than I feared, Tunguska said, his voice as slow and unperturbed as ever. It might not just have been a question of our being trapped inside the sealed shell of the ALS. We don't know what will happen when that wound closes itself.
I don't follow, Auger said. With Cassandra's guidance, she had fashioned a stool for herself next to Tunguska's.
We'd have been trapped inside. That would have been bad, but it's not the worst thing I could imagine happening. There'd have been people on the outside who knew we were there, trying to find a way to rescue us.
They were free now, and it was easy to talk of such things lightly, no matter how terrifying they had seemed at the time.
There's more to it than that, Tunguska said gently. The ALS is entering a new state we haven't seen before, or at least one we haven't witnessed directly.
Again, she said. For the last 23 years, there's been a connection between the interior matter of the ALS and the flow of time in the outside universe. I'm talking about the hyperweb link, of course. We know that it was activated, or brought to full functionality after a period of dormancy, during the Phobos occupation. Until then, Floyd's world had been frozen at the instant of the quantum snapshot. Presumably, it was the establishment of the link that caused time to flow forwards at the normal rate. 23 years in our world, 23 years in Floyd's.
Yes, she said slowly. That much I get. But now there is no hyperweb link. It hasn't just been put into a state of dormancy, as was the case after the Phobos reoccupation until the rediscovery of the portal 2 years ago. It's been completely destroyed. There is no longer any detectable portal machinery in Mars orbit.
But we've been inside the ALS since then, Auger said. We saw E2. We saw that it wasn't frozen in time.
Tunguska looked at her with infinite kindness and compassion in his heavily lidded eyes.
But that was before the closing of the wound, he said gently. Now we have no idea what will happen to E2. Events may continue to roll forward at the normal rate, or the matter inside the ALS may undergo a phase transition back to its frozen state, as it was for more than 300 years.
No, she said. That can't happen because...
But even as she was speaking, she found herself unable to frame any plausible objection. Tunguska might be right, or Tunguska might be wrong. They simply didn't know enough about the ALS or its functioning to work it out.
I'm sorry, he said. I felt I needed to mention the possibility, no matter how remote.
But if that's the case, she said, then I've condemned...
He placed his huge hand on hers. You've condemned no one to anything. Even if the world freezes again, nothing inside it will have been lost.
3 billion lives will just stall between one heartbeat and the next, as they did at the moment of the snapshot. They'll feel nothing. It will be kinder than sleep. And perhaps one day something will happen that will enable that next heartbeat. The world will wake again. We can only hope that when that happens, wiser minds than ours will intervene from outside to assist the world towards its destiny. He patted her hand. But perhaps it won't happen like that anyway. Perhaps the world won't freeze. Perhaps, once awakened, it will always flow forward.
We'll know one day, won't we? Floyd's people won't take long to open their eyes. They must have seen what the wound did to their sky. If they puzzle over that long enough, sooner or later someone's going to make the right connections. And then it'll be them knocking to be let out, rather than us knocking to be let in.
Or they won't knock at all, Auger said. Do baby birds knock to get the mother bird to let them out of the egg?
I confess I've never seen one, Tunguska said.
An egg or a bird?
Either. But I take your point. The one thing we'd be very unwise to do is underestimate the capacity of Floyd's people. Something very like his culture did, after all, give rise to our own.
The poor fools, Auger said. A little while later, they reached the outgoing portal. A chirrup from the automated monitoring station informed them that a real-time communication relay had been established with Polity Space.
It's Moria Skelskard, Tunguska said. Shall I put her on?
Please, Auger said.
The transmission quality was poor. Routing the signal through multiple portal connections was difficult at the best of times, and almost impossible given the chaos back around the sun. Skelskard's image kept flickering or going sound only.
I'll keep this brief, she said. We're only holding things together with spit and prayers at this end. These slasher technicians are good, but they can't work miracles. If the link fails, we'll just have to catch up with each other when you make it back home. In the meantime, everyone's very proud of you. I heard about Floyd, too. I'm sorry it had to end that way for you both.
I'm all right, Auger said.
You don't sound it.
Okay, I'm a wreck. I was never fond of goodbyes under any circumstances. Why the hell did I have to like him, Moria? Why couldn't he have been a prick I couldn't wait to get rid of?
That's the way the universe works, Honeybunch. Better get used to it, because it's going to be around for a good few Hubble times.
Auger forced out a laugh. Just what I need. A sympathetic shoulder.
Skelskard's voice became serious.
Look, the main thing is that the two of you are safe. Given the range of outcomes that were available to us a couple of days ago, I'd say that has to count as a result.
I suppose you're right.
Her thoughts kept returning to Tunguska's speculation about the quantum state of the ALS, but she didn't want to think about that now.
Anyway, it's good to know you're okay as well. I'm glad you made it. How are things back home?
Dicey. I'll need calibration on that. Is that better or worse than a day ago?
I guess you'd have to say it was better by about the width of one of Planck's toenail clippings. The good guys on both sides have brokered some kind of, well, I hesitate to call it a ceasefire just yet. Call it a reduction in the scale of hostilities. That has to be something, right? And of course, some of us have already managed to put aside our differences, or you and I wouldn't be having this long-distance chat.
What about the Earth?
Tanglewood reined in the nuclear strikes. The place is going to glow nicely in the dark for a few centuries, but there should still be some ruins worth poking around in.
I guess we have to take what we're given and be glad it's not worse. When all this is over, I'm still going to have to carry my begging bowl to the funding committees.
Actually, Auger, that's the reason I called.
Skelskard's permanent scowl softened fractionally.
I have some news for you. Not quite sure what to make of it yet, but I do have my suspicions. That is, needless to say, about as preliminary as it gets.
Tell me, Auger said.
You know what they say about an ill wind?
She waited a moment for Auger's reaction, but her face remained blank.
Well, never mind. The point is, we're all upset because we lost a Phobos portal. I've looked at the numbers too, beefed up with some hot new slasher know-how, and it really looks as if we've blown that particular connection.
We shouldn't give up, Auger said firmly. We should always keep trying to reinstate it. E2 is too valuable to give up on.
No one's going to give up on it. Not while there are still so many loopholes in the theory.
but for the time being it may not be our highest priority."
The image fuzzed and gradually reassembled, block by block.
"What have you got?" Orga asked.
"When the Phobos portal blew," Skelskard said,
"something weird happened. We didn't notice it at the time. Our monitoring equipment just wasn't sensitive enough. But the Slashers? Different story. They had the whole system laced with sensors tuned to pick up portal signatures. For years they hadn't detected a squeak, nothing to hint that there were any portals other than the one on Sedna and the one in Phobos. And now? When the Phobos link died, it must have given off some kind of death scream vibration that drew a sympathetic resonance from other dormant links in the vicinity. The sensors picked up faint signals from 15 different locations around the system."
Orga wondered whether she'd heard Skelskard correctly.
15? That may not be the end of it. The weakest signals were at the limit of detection. Could be there are other sources they missed entirely. The whole damn system could be riddled with portals we never even suspected were there. We'd never have found them by accident. They're all buried underground, on anonymous little ice balls no one ever paid much attention to before.
Jesus, Orga said.
Jesus squared. I hope you're impressed.
I am.
Skelskard smiled. I figured you needed cheering up. Like I said, it's preliminary. But as soon as things simmer down around here, we're going to put together a joint expedition and dig down until we find one of these things. Then we're going to switch it on and see where it takes us.
That's a big question.
I know. Out into the galaxy? But what would be the point of that? We already have the Sedna portal for that. Me? I think they'll take us somewhere else entirely.
At first, Orga fought to keep the excitement from her voice. Then she decided she didn't care. What was the point? Skelskard knew exactly how she'd be feeling.
Inside another ALS. That's my best guess. We know there are a lot of them out there. We know one of them contained a snapshot of Earth from the 20th century. Why not other spheres containing other snapshots? There could be dozens of Earths out there, all frozen at different instants in history. One portal might be our ticket into the Middle Ages. Another might put us into the middle of the Triassic.
I need to be on that team, Orga said.
I wouldn't have it any other way. Just remember to bring your best digging clothes. We're not likely to come out so close to a tunnel the next time. I hope you're right about this.
I do too, Skelskard said, just before the communications link finally gave up the ghost. But even if I'm not, I don't think either of us will have to worry about funding committees for a little while.
Floyd slowed his stroll, coming to a stop under a street lamp. He reached out and took hold of the poster gummed to the lamp's fluted shaft and pulled it away, carefully this time, so as not to tear the thing in two. He held the sheet up to the light, peering at the printed image through a shifting veil of fog. It was a picture of Châtelier, except, now that he thought about it, the picture looked a lot like someone else he'd met recently. Not an exact likeness, but enough to raise the hackles of recognition. Not close enough to be the same man, but certainly close enough for them to be brothers. Maybe it was just his imagination. Maybe it wasn't. He folded the poster and shoved it into his pocket. There was a telephone number at the foot of it for anyone who wanted to support Châtelier's political campaign. Floyd thought that maybe tomorrow he might think about paying Châtelier's people a visit, just to ask a few questions, just to make a nuisance of himself. He carried on into the city, counting down the street numbers, looking for some essential landmark. Somewhere in the distance he heard a maritime foghorn blare into the night. A telephone kiosk loomed out of the void like a lighthouse. He stepped inside and closed the door, tried the money return hatch and pulled out a single coin. His lucky day. Floyd fed the telephone and dialed a number in Montparnasse that he knew by memory. Sophie answered.
"This is Floyd," he said. "I hope it's not too late. Is Greta there?"
"Just a moment."
"Wait," he said, before she stepped away to find Greta. "Is Marguerite still..."
"She's still alive, yes."
"Thank you.
I'll fetch Greta. She's upstairs."
He waited, drumming his fingers on the glass door of the telephone box. They hadn't parted on the best of terms. How was she going to take his coming back now, after all the time he'd been away? Someone picked up the receiver.
Floyd? Greta?
It's me. Where are you?
Somewhere in Paris. Not exactly sure where. I'm trying to find my way back to the Rue du Dragon.
We were worried, Floyd. Where have you been? We've had people out looking for you all day.
She sounded concerned and confused rather than angry.
I've been away, he said, wondering what she meant by all day.
He'd been away longer than that, surely.
With Auger. Where is she now?
Gone.
Gone as in...
Gone as in gone. I don't think I'll be seeing her again. She seemed to go and then come back. When she returned, something had changed in her voice. Some crack of forgiveness had opened up.
I'm sorry, Floyd.
It's all right. But it wasn't all right. Not at all.
Floyd, where are you? I can send a taxi.
It's okay. I need the walk. Can I come around tomorrow?
Yes, of course. I'll be here all morning.
I'll be there first thing. I'd like to see Marguerite. I have something for her.
She still thinks you're going to show up with strawberries,
Greta said sadly. I'll see you in the morning.
Floyd, before you hang up, I'm still serious about America. You've had time now, haven't you? Time to think. And now that you don't have any other distractions.
You're right, he said. I've had time to think. And I think you're right. America will be good for you.
Does that mean you've come to a decision?
Kind of, he said. He put down the receiver and stepped out of the kiosk. Suddenly the fog cleared a little, enough to give him a better view of the street on which he stood. Some glimmer of recognition teased his memory. He knew where he was, more or less. He had been heading in the right direction all along. Floyd reached into his pocket. The bag of strawberries was still there, like some token from a dream that had no business existing in the real world. The little vial of UR was there as well. He thought of Greta getting on that seaplane to America, turning a new corner in her life. Something brighter and more wide open than he could ever offer her in Paris. Something brighter and more wide open than he could offer her if he went to America with her too. And then he thought of her staying here, out of love, nursing Marguerite out of her illness, while that other life slipped further and further from her grasp. He took out the vial and dropped it onto the cobbles. He crunched it underfoot and lost himself in the fog. This concludes Century Rain. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call, toll-free, 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.